Beginners, the manuscript version of what we talk about when we talk about love. Why don't you dance? In the kitchen, he poured another drink and looked at the bedroom suite in his front yard. The mattress was stripped and the candy-striped sheets lay beside two pillows on the chiffonier. Except for that, things looked much the way they had in the bedroom. Nightstand and reading lamp on his side of the bed, a nightstand and reading lamp on her side, his side, her side. He considered this as he sipped the whiskey. The chiffonier stood a few feet from the foot of the bed. He had emptied the drawers into cartons that morning, and the cartons were in the living room. A portable heater was next to the chiffonier. A rattan chair with a decorator pillow stood at the foot of the bed. The buffed aluminum kitchen set occupied a part of the driveway. A yellow muslin cloth, much too large, a gift, covered the table and hung down over the sides. A potted fern was on the table, along with a box of silverware, also a gift. A big console model television set rested on a coffee table, and a few feet away from this, a sofa and chair and a floor lamp. He had run an extension cord from the house, and everything was connected, things worked. The desk was pushed against the garage door. A few utensils were on the desk, along with a wall clock and two framed prints. There was also, in the driveway, a carton with cups, glasses, and plates, each object wrapped in newspaper. That morning he had cleared out the closets and, except for the three cartons in the living room, everything was out of the house. Now and then a car slowed and people stared, but no one stopped. It occurred to him that he wouldn't either. "It must be a yard sale, for God's sake," the girl said to the boy. This girl and boy were furnishing a little apartment. "Let's see what they want for the bed," the girl said.
"I wonder what they want for the TV," the boy said.
He pulled into the driveway and stopped in front of the kitchen table. They got out of the car and began to examine things. The girl touched the muslin cloth. The boy plugged in the blender and turned the dial to mince. She picked up a chafing dish. He turned on the television set and made careful adjustments. He sat down on the sofa to watch. He lit a cigarette, looked around, and flipped the match into the grass. The girl sat on the bed. She pushed off her shoes and lay back. She could see the evening star. "Come here, Jack. Try this bed. Bring one of those pillows," she said.
"How is it?"
he said. "Try it," she said. He looked around. The house was dark.
"I feel funny," he said. "Better see if anybody's home."
She bounced on the bed. "Try it first," she said. He lay down on the bed and put the pillow under his head. "How does it feel?" the girl said.
"Feels firm," he said.
She turned on her side and put her arm around his neck. "Kiss me," she said.
"Let's get up," he said.
Kiss me, honey," she said. She closed her eyes. She held him. He had to prise her fingers loose. He said,
"I'll see if anybody's home." But he just sat up.
The television set was still playing. Lights had gone on in houses up and down the street. He sat on the edge of the bed. "Wouldn't it be funny if," the girl said and grinned and didn't finish. He laughed. He switched on the reading lamp. She brushed away a mosquito. He stood up and tucked his shirt in.
"I'll see if anybody's home," he said. "I don't think anybody's home, but if they are, I'll see what things are going for."
"Whatever they ask, offer them $10 less," she said. "They must be desperate or something." She sat on the bed and watched television. "You might as well turn that up," the girl said and giggled.
"It's a pretty good TV," he said.
"Ask them how much," she said. Max came down the sidewalk with a sack from the market. He had sandwiches, beer, and whiskey. He had continued to drink through the afternoon and had reached a place where now the drinking seemed to begin to sober him. But there were gaps. He had stopped at the bar next to the market, had listened to a song on the jukebox, and somehow it had gotten dark before he recalled the things in his yard.
He saw the car in the driveway and the girl on the bed. The television set was playing. Then he saw the boy on the porch. He started across the yard. "Hello," he said to the girl. "You found the bed. That's good."
"Hello," the girl said and got up. "I was just trying it out." She patted the bed. "It's a pretty good bed."
"It's a good bed," Max said. "What do I say next?" He knew he should say something next. He put down the sack and took out the beer and whiskey. "We thought nobody was here," the boy said. "We're interested in the bed and maybe the TV, maybe the desk. How much do you want for the bed?"
"I was thinking $50 for the bed,"
Max said. "Would you take 40?" the girl asked.
"Okay, I'll take 40," Max said.
He took a glass out of the carton, took the newspaper off it, and broke the seal on the whiskey.
"How about the TV?" the boy said.
25.
"Would you take 20? The girl said.
20's okay. I could take 20,
Max said. The girl looked at the boy.
"You kids, you want a drink?"
Max said.
"Glasses in that box." I'm going to sit down on the sofa."
He sat on the sofa, leaned back, and stared at them. The boy found two glasses and poured whiskey.
"How much of this do you want?"
he said to the girl. They were only 20 years old, the boy and girl, a month or so apart. "That's enough," she said. "I think I want water in mine." She pulled out a chair and sat at the kitchen table.
"There's water in that faucet over there," Max said. "Turn on that faucet."
The boy added water to the whiskey, his and hers. He cleared his throat before he sat down at the kitchen table, too. Then he grinned. Birds darted overhead for insects. Max gazed at the television. He finished his drink. He reached to turn on the floor lamp and dropped his cigarette between the cushions. The girl got up to help him find it.
"You want anything else, honey?"
the boy said. He took out the checkbook. He poured more whiskey for himself and the girl.
"Oh, I want the desk," the girl said. "How much money is the desk?"
Max waved his hand at this preposterous question.
"Name a figure," he said.
He looked at them as they sat at the table. In the lamplight, there was something about the expression on their faces. For a minute, this expression seemed conspiratorial, and then it became tender. There was no other word for it. The boy touched her hand.
"I'm going to turn off this TV and put on a record," Max announced. "This record player is going too. Cheap. Name a figure."
He poured more whiskey and opened a beer.
"Everything goes."
The girl held out her glass and Max poured more whiskey.
"Thank you," she said.
"It goes right to your head," the boy said. "I'm getting a buzz on."
He finished his drink, waited, and poured another. He was writing a check when Max found the records.
"Pick something you like," Max said to the girl and held the records before her.
The boy went on writing the check.
"Here,"
the girl said, pointing. She did not know the names on these records, but that was all right. This was an adventure. She got up from the table and sat down again. She didn't want to sit still.
"I'm making it out to cash," the boy said, still writing.
"Sure,"
Max said. He drank off the whiskey and followed it with some beer. He sat down again on the sofa and crossed one leg over the other. They drank. They listened until the record ended, and then Max put on another.
"Why don't you kids dance?"
Max said.
"That's a good idea. Why don't you dance?"
"No, I don't think so," the boy said. "You want to dance, Carla?"
"Go ahead," Max said. "It's my driveway. You can dance."
Arms about each other, their bodies pressed together, the boy and girl moved up and down the driveway. They were dancing. When the record ended, the girl asked Max to dance. She was still without her shoes.
"I'm drunk," he said.
"You're not drunk," the girl said.
"Well, I'm drunk," the boy said.
Max turned the record over, and the girl came up to him. They began to dance. The girl looked at the people gathered at the bay window across the street.
Those people over there, watching, she said. Is it okay?
It's okay, Max said. It's my driveway. We can dance. They thought they'd seen everything over here, but they haven't seen this, he said.
In a minute, he felt her warm breath on his neck, and he said,
I hope you like your bed.
I will,
the girl said.
I hope the both of you do,
Max said.
Jack, the girl said, wake up.
Jack had his chin propped and was watching them sleepily.
Jack,
the girl said. She closed and opened her eyes. She pushed her face into Max's shoulder. She pulled him closer.
Jack,
the girl murmured. She looked at the bed and could not understand what it was doing in the yard. She looked over Max's shoulder at the sky. She held herself to Max. She was filled with an unbearable happiness. The girl said later,
This guy was about middle-aged. All his belongings right out there in his yard. I'm not kidding. We got drunk and danced. In the driveway. Oh my God. Don't laugh. He played records. Look at this phonograph. He gave it to us. These old records, too. Jack and I went to sleep in his bed. Jack was hungover and had to rent a trailer in the morning to move all the guy's stuff. Once I woke up, he was covering us with a blanket, the guy was. This blanket, feel it.
She kept talking. She told everyone. There was more, she knew that, but she couldn't get it into words. After a time, she quit talking about it. Viewfinder.
A man without hands came to the door to sell me a photograph of my house. Except for the chrome hooks, he was an ordinary-looking man of 50 or so. How did you lose your hands? I asked, after he'd said what he wanted. That's another story, he said. You want this picture of your house or not? Come on in, I said. I just made coffee. I just made some jello, too, but I didn't tell him that. I might use your toilet, the man with no hands said. I wanted to see how he would hold a cup of coffee using those hooks. I knew how he used the camera. It was an old Polaroid camera, big and black. It fastened to leather straps that looped over his shoulders and around his back, securing the camera to his chest. He would stand on the sidewalk in front of a house, locate the house in the viewfinder, depress the lever with one of his hooks, and out popped the picture in a minute or so. I'd been watching from the window. Where'd you say the toilet was? Down there, turn right. By this time, bending and hunching, he'd let himself out of the straps. He put the camera on the sofa and straightened his jacket. You can look at this while I'm gone. I took the photograph from him. There was a little rectangle of lawn, the driveway, carport, front steps, bay window, kitchen window. Why would I want a photograph of this tragedy? I looked closer and saw the outline of my head. My head. Behind the kitchen window and a few steps back from the sink. I looked at the photograph for a time, and then I heard the toilet flush. He came down the hall, zipped and smiling, one hook holding his belt, the other tucking his shirt in. What do you think? He said. All right. Personally, I think it turned out fine. But then I know what I'm doing, and let's face it, it's not that hard shooting a house, unless the weather's inclement. But when the weather's inclement, I don't work except inside. Special assignment type work, you know. He plucked at his crotch. Here's coffee, I said. You're alone, right? He looked at the living room. He shook his head. Hard, hard. He sat next to the camera, leaned back with a sigh, and closed his eyes. Drink your coffee, I said. I sat in a chair across from him. A week before, three kids in baseball caps had come to the house. One of them had said, Can we paint your address on the curb, sir? Everybody on the street's doing it. Just a dollar. Two boys waited on the sidewalk, one of them with a can of white paint at his feet, the other holding a brush. All three boys had their sleeves rolled. Three kids were here a while back wanting to paint my address on the curb. They wanted a dollar, too. You wouldn't know anything about that, would you? It was a long shot, but I watched him just the same. He leaned forward importantly, the cup balanced between his hooks. He carefully placed the cup on the little table. He looked at me. That's crazy, you know. I work alone. Always have, always will. What are you saying? I was trying to make a connection, I said. I had a headache. Coffee's no good for it, but sometimes Jell-O helps. I picked up the photograph. I was in the kitchen, I said. I know. I saw you from the street. How often does that happen? Getting somebody in the picture along with the house. Usually I'm in the back.
Happens all the time, he said. It's a sure sell. Sometimes they see me shooting the house, and they come out and ask me to make sure I get them in the picture. Maybe the lady of the house, she wants me to snap hubby washing his car. Or else there's Junior working the lawnmower, and she says, get him, get him. And I get him. Or the little family is gathered on the patio for a nice little lunch, and what I please.
His right leg began to jiggle.
So they just up and left you, right? Packed up and left. It hurts. Kids I don't know about. Not anymore. I don't like kids. I don't even like my own kids. I work alone, as I said. The picture?
I'll take it, I said. I stood up for the cups. You don't live around here. Where do you live?
Right now I have a room downtown. It's okay. I take a bus out, you know. And after I've worked all the neighborhoods, I go somewhere else. There's better ways to go, but I get by.
What about your kids? I waited with the cups and watched him struggle up from the sofa.
Screw them. Their mother, too. They're what gave me this.
He brought the hooks up in front of my face. He turned and started pulling into his straps.
I'd like to forgive and forget, you know, but I can't. I still hurt, and that's the trouble. I can't forgive or forget.
I looked again at the hooks as they maneuvered the straps. It was wonderful to see what he could do with those hooks.
Thanks for the coffee and the use of the toilet. You're going through the mill now. I sympathize.
He raised and lowered his hooks.
What can I do?
Take more pictures, I said. I want you to take pictures of me and the house both.
It won't work, he said. She won't come back.
I don't want her back, I said. He snorted. He looked at me.
I can give you a rate, he said. Three for a dollar? If I went any lower, I'd hardly come out.
We went outside. He adjusted the shutter. He told me where to stand, and we got down to it. We moved around the house. Very systematic we were. Sometimes I'd look sideways. Other times I'd look straight into the camera. Just getting outside helped.
Good, he'd say. That's good. That one turned out real nice. Let's see,
he said after we'd circled the house and were back in the driveway again.
That's 20. You want any more?
Two or three more, I said. On the roof. I'll go up and you can shoot me from down here.
Jesus, he said.
He looked up and down the street.
Well, sure, go ahead, but be careful.
You were right, I said. They did just up and move out. The whole kit and caboodle. You were right on target. The man with no hands said,
You didn't need to say word one. I knew the instant you opened the door.
He shook his hooks at me.
You feel like she cut the ground right out from under you. Took your legs in the process. Look at this. This is what they leave you with. Screw it, he said. You want to get up on that roof or not? I've got to go,
the man said. I brought a chair out and put it under the edge of the carport. I still couldn't reach. He stood in the driveway and watched me. I found a crate and put that on the chair. I climbed onto the chair and then the crate. I raised up onto the carport, walked to the roof, and made my way on hands and knees across the shingles to a little flat place near the chimney. I stood up and looked around. There was a breeze. I waved, and he waved back with both hooks. Then I saw the rocks. It was like a little rock nest there on the screen over the chimney hole. Kids must have lobbed them up trying to land them in the chimney. I picked up one of the rocks. Ready? I called. He had me located in his viewfinder.
Okay,
he answered. I turned and threw back my arm.
Now,
I called. I hooked that rock as far as I could, south.
I don't know, I heard him say. You moved, he said. We'll see in a minute.
And in a minute he said, by God, it's okay. He looked at it. He held it up.
You know, he said, it's good.
Once more, I called. I picked up another rock. I grinned. I felt I could lift off, fly. Now, I called.
Where is everyone?
I've seen some things. I was going over to my mother's to stay a few nights, but just as I came to the top of the stairs, I looked and she was on the sofa kissing a man. It was summer, the door was open, and the color TV was playing. My mother is 65 and lonely. She belongs to a singles club. But even so, knowing all this, it was hard. I stood at the top of the stairs with my hand on the railing and watched as the man pulled her deeper into the kiss. She was kissing back, and the TV was going on the other side of the room. It was Sunday, about 5 in the afternoon. People from the apartment house were down below in the pool. I went back down the stairs and out to my car. A lot has happened since that afternoon, and on the whole, things are better now. But during those days, when my mother was putting out to men she'd just met, I was out of work, drinking, and crazy. My kids were crazy, and my wife was crazy, and having a thing with an unemployed aerospace engineer she'd met at AA. He was crazy, too. His name was Ross, and he had 5 or 6 kids. He walked with a limp from a gunshot wound his first wife had given him. He didn't have a wife now, he wanted my wife. I don't know what we were all thinking of in those days. The second wife had come and gone, but it was the first wife who had shot him in the thigh some years back, giving him the limp, and who now had him in and out of court or in jail every 6 months or so for not meeting his support payments. I wish him well now. But it was different then. More than once in those days, I mentioned weapons. I'd say to my wife, I'd shout it, I'm going to kill him. But nothing ever happened. Things lurched on. I never met the man, though we talked on the phone a few times. I did find a couple of pictures of him once when I was going through my wife's purse. He was a little guy, not too little, and he had a mustache and was wearing a striped jersey, waiting for a kid to come down the slide. In the other picture, he was standing against a house. My house? I couldn't tell. With his arms crossed, dressed up, wearing a tie. Ross, you son of a bitch. I hope you're okay now. I hope things are better for you, too. The last time he'd been jailed, a month before that Sunday, I found out from my daughter that her mother had gone bail for him. Daughter Kate, who was 15, didn't take to this any better than I did. It wasn't that she had any loyalty to me in this. She had no loyalties to me or her mother in anything, and was only too willing to sell either one of us down the river. No, it was that there was a serious cash flow problem in the house, and if money went to Ross, there'd be that much less for what she needed. So Ross was on her list now. Also, she didn't like his kids, she'd said. But she'd told me once before that in general, Ross was all right, even funny and interesting when he wasn't drinking. He'd even told her fortune. He spent his time repairing things, now that he could no longer hold a job in the aerospace industry. But I'd seen his house from the outside, and the place looked like a dumping ground, with all kinds and makes of old appliances and equipment that would never wash or cook or play again. All of it just standing in his open garage, and in his drive and in the front yard. He also kept some broken-down cars around that he liked to tinker on. In the first stages of their affair, my wife had told me he collected antique cars. Those were her words. I'd seen some of his cars parked in front of his house when I'd driven by there trying to see what I could see. Old 1950s and 1960s, dented cars with torn seat covers. They were junkers, that's all. I knew. I had his number. We had things in common, more than just driving old cars and trying to hold on for dear life to the same woman. Still, handyman or not, he couldn't manage to tune my wife's car properly or fix our TV set when it broke down and we lost the picture. We had volume, but no picture. If we wanted to get the news, we'd have to sit around the screen at night and listen to the set. I'd drink and make some crack to my kids about Mr. Fix-It. Even now, I don't know if my wife believed that stuff or not, about antique cars and such. But she cared for him. She loved him, even. That's pretty clear now. They'd met when Cynthia was trying to stay sober and was going to meetings 3 or 4 times a week.
I had been in and out of AA for several months, though when Cynthia met Ross, I was out and drinking a fifth a day of anything I could get my hands on. But as I heard Cynthia say to someone over the phone about me, I'd had the exposure to AA and knew where to go when I really wanted help. Ross had been in AA and then had gone back to drinking again. Cynthia felt, I think, that maybe there was more hope for him than for me, and tried to help him, and so went to the meetings to keep herself sober, then went over to cook for him or clean his house. His kids were no help to him in this regard. Nobody lifted a hand around his house except Cynthia when she was there. But the less his kids pitched in, the more he loved them. It was strange. It was the opposite with me. I hated my kids during this time. I'd be on the sofa with a glass of vodka and grapefruit juice when one of them would come in from school and slam the door. One afternoon, I screamed and got into a scuffle with my son. Cynthia had to break it up when I threatened to knock him to pieces. I said it would kill him. I said, I gave you life and I can take it away. Madness. The kids, Katie and Mike, were only too happy to take advantage of this crumbling situation. They seemed to thrive on the threats and bullying they inflicted on each other and on us. The violence and dismay, the general bedlam. Right now, thinking about it even from this distance, it makes me set my heart against them. I remember years before I turned to drinking full-time, reading an extraordinary scene in a novel by an Italian named Italo Svevo. The narrator's father was dying and the family had gathered around the bed, weeping and waiting for the old man to expire, when he opened his eyes to look at each of them for a last time. When his gaze fell on the narrator, he suddenly stirred and something came into his eyes, and with his last burst of strength he raised up, flung himself across the bed, and slapped the face of his son as hard as he could. Then he fell back onto the bed and died. I often imagined my own deathbed scene in those days, and I saw myself doing the same thing, only I would hope to have the strength to slap each of my kids, and my last words for them would be what only a dying man would have the courage to utter. But they saw craziness on every side, and it suited their purpose, I was convinced. They fattened on it. They liked being able to call the shots, having the upper hand, while we bungled along letting them work on our guilt. They might have been inconvenienced from time to time, but they ran things their way. They weren't embarrassed or put out by any of the activities that went on in our house either. To the contrary, it gave them something to talk about with their friends. I've heard them regaling their pals with the most frightful stories, howling with laughter as they spilled out the lurid details of what was happening to me and their mother. Except for being financially dependent on Cynthia, who still somehow had a teaching job and a monthly paycheck, they flat out ran the show. And that's what it was, too, a show. Once Mike locked his mother out of the house after she'd stayed overnight at Ross's house. I don't know where I was that night, probably at my mother's. I'd sleep over there sometimes. I'd eat supper with her and she'd tell me how she worried about all of us. Then we'd watch TV and try to talk about something else, try to hold a normal conversation about something other than my family situation. She'd make a bed for me on her sofa, the same sofa she used to make love on, I supposed. But I'd sleep there anyway and be grateful. Cynthia came home at 7 o'clock one morning to get dressed for school and found that Mike had locked all the doors and windows and wouldn't let her in the house. She stood outside his window and begged him to let her in, please, please, so she could dress and go to school, for if she lost her job, what then? Where would he be? Where would any of us be then? He said, you don't live here anymore, why should I let you in? That's what he said to her, standing behind his window, his face all stopped up with rage. She told me this later when she was drunk and I was sober and holding her hands and letting her talk. You don't live here, he said. Please, 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 Mike, she pleaded. Let me in. He let her in and she swore at him. Like that, he punched her hard on the shoulders several times. Whop, whop, whop. Then hit her on the top of the head and generally worked her over. Finally, she was able to change clothes, fix her face, and rush off to school. All this happened not too long ago, 3 years about. It was something in those days. I left my mother with the man on her sofa and drove around for a while, not wanting to go home and not wanting to sit in a bar that day either. Sometimes Cynthia and I would talk about things, reviewing the situation, we'd call it. But now and then, on rare occasions, we'd talk a little about things that bore no relation to the situation. One afternoon we were in the living room and she said, when I was pregnant with Mike, You carried me to the bathroom when I was so sick and pregnant I couldn't get out of bed. You carried me. No one else will ever do that. No one else could ever love me in that way, that much. We have that, no matter what. We've loved each other like nobody else could or ever will love the other again. We looked at each other. Maybe we touched hands, I don't recall. Then I remembered the half pint of whiskey or vodka or gin or scotch or tequila that I had hidden under the very sofa cushion we were sitting on. Oh, happy days. And I began to hope she might soon have to get up and move around. Go to the kitchen, the bathroom, out to clean the garage. Maybe you could make us some coffee, I said. A pot of coffee might be nice. Would you eat something? I can fix some soup. Maybe I could eat something, but I'll for sure drink a cup of coffee. She went out to the kitchen. I waited until I heard her begin to run water. Then I reached under the cushion for the bottle, unscrewed the lid, and drank. I never told these things at AA. I never said much at the meetings. I'd pass, as they called it. When it came your turn to speak and you didn't say anything except, I'll pass tonight, thanks. But I would listen and shake my head and laugh in recognition at the awful stories I heard. Usually I was drunk when I went to those first meetings. You're scared and you need something more than cookies and instant coffee. But those conversations touching on love or the past were rare. If we talked, we talked about business, survival, the bottom line of things. Money. Where is the money going to come from? The telephone was on the way out. The lights and gas threatened. What about Katie? She needs clothes. Her grades. That boyfriend of hers is a biker. Mike. What's going to happen to Mike? What's going to happen to us all? My God, she'd say. But God wasn't having any of it. He'd washed his hands of us. I wanted Mike to join the Army, Navy, or the Coast Guard. He was impossible. A dangerous character. Even Ross felt the army would be good for him, Cynthia had told me, and she hadn't liked him telling her that a bit. But I was pleased to hear this, and to find out that Ross and I were in agreement on the matter. Ross went up a peg in my estimation, but it angered Cynthia because, miserable as Mike was to have around, despite his violent streak, she thought it was just a phase that would soon pass. She didn't want him in the army. But Ross told Cynthia that Mike belonged in the army where he'd learn respect and manners. He told her this after there'd been a pushing and shoving match out in his drive in the early morning hours and Mike had thrown him down on the pavement. Ross loved Cynthia, but he also had a 22-year-old girl named Beverly who was pregnant with his baby, though Ross assured Cynthia he loved her, not Beverly. They didn't even sleep together any longer, he told Cynthia. But Beverly was carrying his baby, and he loved all his children, even the unborn, and he couldn't just give her the boot, could he? He wept when he told all this to Cynthia. He was drunk. Someone was always drunk in those days. I can imagine the scene. Ross had graduated from California Polytechnic Institute and gone right to work at the NASA operation in Mountain View. He worked there for 10 years until it all fell in on him. I never met him, as I said. But we talked on the phone several times about one thing and another. I called him once when I was drunk and Cynthia and I were debating some sad point or another. One of his children answered the phone, and when Ross came on the line, I asked him whether, if I pulled out, I had no intention of pulling out, of course, it was just harassment, he intended to support Cynthia and our kids. He said he was carving a roast, that's what he said, and they were just going to sit down and eat their dinner, he and his children. Could he call me back? I hung up. When he called after an hour or so, I'd forgotten about the earlier call. Cynthia answered the phone and said yes, and then yes again, and I knew it was Ross and that he was asking if I was drunk. I grabbed the phone. Well, are you going to support them or not? He said he was sorry for his part in all of this, but no, he guessed he couldn't support them. So it's no, you can't support them, I said, and looked at Cynthia as if this should settle everything. He said, yes, it's no. But Cynthia didn't bat an eye. I figured later they'd already talked that situation over thoroughly, so it was no surprise. She already knew. He was in his mid-30s when he went under. I used to make fun of him when I had the chance. I called him the Weasel after his photograph. That's what your mother's boyfriend looks like, I'd say to my kids if they were around and we were talking, like a weasel. We'd laugh. Or else, Mr. Fix-It. That was my favorite name for him. God bless and keep you, Ross. I don't hold anything against you now. But in those days, when I called him the weasel or Mr. Fix-It and threatened his life, he was something of a fallen hero to my kids, and to Cynthia, too, I suppose. Because he'd helped put men on the moon. He'd worked, I was told, time and again, on the moon project shots, and he was close friends with Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong. He'd told Cynthia, and Cynthia had told the kids who'd told me, that when the astronauts came to town, he was going to introduce them. But they never came to town, or if they did, they forgot to contact Ross. Soon after the moon probes, fortune's wheel turned and Ross's drinking increased. He began missing work. Somewhere then, the troubles with his first wife started. Toward the end, he began taking the drink to work with him in a thermos. It's a modern operation out there, I've seen it. Cafeteria lines, executive dining rooms and the like, Mr. Coffee's in every office. But he brought his own thermos to work, and after a while, people began to know and to talk. He was laid off, or else he quit. Nobody could ever give me a straight answer when I asked. He kept drinking, of course. You do that. Then he commenced working on ruined appliances and doing TV repair work and fixing cars. He was interested in astrology, auras, I Ching, that business. I don't doubt that he was bright enough and interesting and quirky, like most of our ex-friends. I told Cynthia I was sure she wouldn't care for him. I couldn't yet bring myself to use the word love, then, about that relationship. If he wasn't basically a good man. One of us, was how I put it, trying to be large about it. He wasn't a bad or an evil man, Ross. No one's evil, I said once to Cynthia when we were discussing my own affair. My dad died in his sleep, drunk, 8 years ago. It was a Friday night and he was 54 years old. He came home from work at the sawmill, took some sausage out of the freezer for his breakfast the next morning, and sat down at the kitchen table where he opened a quart of Four Roses. He was in good enough spirits in those days, glad to be back on a job after being out of work for 3 or 4 years with blood poisoning, and then something that caused him to have shock treatments. I was married and living in another town during that time. I had the kids and a job, enough troubles of my own, so I couldn't follow his too closely. That night he moved into the living room with his bottle, a bowl of ice cubes and a glass, and drank and watched TV until my mother came in from work at the coffee shop. They had a few words about the whiskey, as they always did. She didn't drink much herself. When I was grown, I only saw her drink at Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's, eggnog or buttered rums, and then never too many. The one time she had had too much to drink, years before, I heard this from my dad, who laughed about it when he told it. They'd gone to a little place outside Eureka, and she'd had a great many whiskey sours. Just as they got into the car to leave, she started to get sick and had to open the door. Somehow her false teeth came out, the car moved forward a little, and a tire passed over her dentures. After that, she never drank except on holidays, and then never to excess. My dad kept on drinking that Friday night and tried to ignore my mother, who sat out in the kitchen and smoked and tried to write a letter to her sister in Little Rock. Finally, he got up and went to bed. My mother went to bed not long after, when she was sure he was asleep. She said later she noticed nothing out of the ordinary, except maybe his snoring seemed heavier and deeper, and she couldn't get him to turn on his side. But she went to sleep. She woke up when my dad's sphincter muscles and bladder let go. It was just sunrise. Birds were singing. My dad was still on his back, eyes closed and mouth open. My mother looked at him and cried his name. I kept driving around. It was dark by now. I drove by my house, every light ablaze, but Cynthia's car wasn't in the drive. I went to a bar where I sometimes drank and called home. Katie answered and said her mother wasn't there, and where was I? She needed $5. I shouted something and hung up. Then I called collect to a woman 600 miles away whom I hadn't seen in months, a good woman who, the last time I'd seen her, had said she would pray for me. She accepted the charges. She asked where I was calling from. She asked how I was. Are you all right? She said. We talked. I asked about her husband. He'd been a friend of mine and was now living away from her and the children.
He's still in Richland, she said. How did all this happen to us? She asked. We started out good people.
We talked a while longer, then she said she still loved me and that she would continue to pray for me. Pray for me, I said. Yes. Then we said goodbye and hung up. Later, I called home again, but this time no one answered. I dialed my mother's number. She picked up the phone on the first ring, her voice cautious, as if expecting trouble. It's me, I said. I'm sorry to be calling.
No, no, honey, I was up, she said. Where are you? Is anything the matter? I thought you were coming over today. I looked for you. Are you calling from home?
I'm not at home, I said. I don't know where everyone is at home. I just called there.
Old Ken was over here today, she went on. That old bastard. He came over this afternoon. I haven't seen him in a month and he just shows up, the old thing. I don't like him. All he wants to do is talk about himself and brag on himself and how he lived on Guam and had three girlfriends at the same time and how he's traveled to this place and that place. He's just an old braggart, that's all he is. I met him at that dance I told you about, but I don't like him.
Is it all right if I come over? I said.
Honey, why don't you? I'll fix us something to eat. I'm hungry myself. I haven't eaten anything since this afternoon. Old Ken brought some Colonel Sanders over this afternoon. Come over and I'll fix us some scrambled eggs. Do you want me to come get you? Honey, are you all right?
I drove over. She kissed me when I came in the door. I turned my face. I hated for her to smell the vodka. The TV was on.
Wash your hands, she said as she studied me. It's ready.
Later, she made a bed for me on the sofa. I went into the bathroom. She kept a pair of my dad's pajamas in there. I took them out of the drawer, looked at them, and began undressing. When I came out, she was in the kitchen. I fixed the pillow and lay down. She finished with what she was doing, turned off the kitchen light, and sat down at the end of the sofa.
Honey, I don't want to be the one to tell you this, she said. It hurts me to tell you, but even the kids know it, and they've told me. We've talked about it. But Cynthia is seeing another man.
That's okay, I said. I know that, I said and looked at the TV. His name is Ross and he's an alcoholic. He's like me.
Honey, you're going to have to do something for yourself, she said.
I know it, I said. I kept looking at the TV. She leaned over and hugged me. She held me a minute. Then she let it go and wiped her eyes.
I'll get you up in the morning, she said.
I don't have much to do tomorrow. I might sleep in a while after you go. I thought, after you get up, after you've gone to the bathroom and gotten dressed, then I'll get into your bed and lie there and doze and listen to your radio out in the kitchen giving the news and weather.
Honey, I'm so worried about you.
Don't worry, I said. I shook my head.
You get some rest now, she said. You need to sleep.
I'll sleep. I'm very sleepy.
Watch television as long as you want, she said.
I nodded. She bent and kissed me. Her lips seemed bruised and swollen. She drew the blanket over me. Then she went into her bedroom. She left the door open, and in a minute I could hear her snoring. I lay there staring at the TV. There were images of uniformed men on the screen, a low murmur, then tanks and a man using a flamethrower. I couldn't hear it, but I didn't want to get up. I kept staring until I felt my eyes close. But I woke up with a start, the pajamas damp with sweat. A snowy light filled the room. There was a roaring coming at me. The room clamored. I lay there. I didn't move. Gazebo.
That morning, she pours teacher's scotch over my belly and licks it off. In the afternoon, she tries to jump out the window. I can't stand this anymore, and I tell her so. I go, Holly, this can't continue. This is crazy. This has got to stop.
We are sitting on the sofa in one of the upstairs suites. There were any number of vacancies to choose from, but we needed a suite, a place to move around in and be able to talk. So we'd locked up the motel office that morning and gone upstairs to a suite. She goes,
Dwayne, this is killing.
We are drinking teachers with ice and water. We'd slept a while between morning and afternoon. Then she was out of bed and threatening to climb out the window in her undergarments. I had to get her in a hold.
We're only 2 floors up, but even so.
I've had it, she goes. I can't take it anymore.
She puts the back of her hand to her cheek and closes her eyes. She turns her head back and forth and makes this humming noise. I could die seeing her like this. Take what? I go, though of course I know. Holly?
I don't have to spell it out for you again, she goes. I've lost self-control. I've lost my pride. I used to be a proud woman.
She's an attractive woman, just past 30. She's tall and has long black hair and green eyes, the only green-eyed woman I've ever known. In the old days, I used to comment on her green eyes, and she'd tell me she knew she was meant for something special. And didn't I know it? I feel so awful from one thing and the other. Downstairs in the office, I can hear the telephone ringing again. It has been ringing off and on all day. Even when I was dozing earlier, I could hear it. I'd open my eyes and look at the ceiling and listen to it ring and wonder at what was happening to us.
My heart is broken, she goes. It's turned to a piece of stone. I'm no longer responsible. That's what's as bad as anything, that I'm not responsible anymore. I don't even want to get up mornings. Duane, it's taken a long time to come to this decision, but we have to go our separate ways. It's over, Duane. We may as well admit it.
Holly, I go. I reach for her hand, but she draws away. When we'd first moved down here and taken over as motel managers, we thought we were out of the woods. Free rent and utilities, plus $300 a month, you couldn't beat it. Holly took care of the books, she was good with figures, and she did most of the renting of the units. She liked people, and people liked her back. I saw to the grounds, mowed the grass and cut weeds, kept the swimming pool clean, did minor repairs. Everything was fine for the first year. I was holding down another job nights, a swing shift, and we were getting ahead, rich in plans. Then one morning, I don't know. I'd just laid some bathroom tile in one of the units when this little Mexican maid comes in to clean. Holly had hired her. I can't really say I'd noticed her before, though we spoke when we saw each other. She called me Mister. Anyway, one thing and the other, we talked. She wasn't dumb. She was cute and had a nice way about her. She liked to smile, would listen with great intent when you said something, and looked you in the eyes when she talked. After that morning, I started paying attention when I'd see her. She was a neat, compact little woman with fine white teeth. I used to watch her mouth when she laughed. She started calling me by my first name. One morning, I was in another unit, replacing a washer for one of the bathroom faucets. She didn't know I was there. She came in and turned on the TV, as maids are in the habit of doing while they clean. I stopped what I was doing and stepped outside the bathroom. She was surprised to see me. She smiled and said my name. We looked at each other. I walked over and closed the door behind her. I put my arms around her. Then we lay down on the bed. Holly, you're still a proud woman, I go. You're still number one. Come on, Holly. She shakes her head.
Something's died in me, she goes. It took a long time for it to die, but it's dead. You've killed someone, just like you'd take an axe to it. Everything is dirt now.
She finishes her drink, then she begins to cry. I make to hug her, but she gets up and goes into the bathroom. I freshen our drinks and look out the window. 2 cars with out-of-state plates are parked in front of the office. The drivers, 2 men, are standing in front of the office, talking. One of them finishes saying something to the other, looks around at the units, and pulls his chin. A woman has her face up to the glass, hand shielding her eyes, peering inside. She tries the door. The phone begins ringing in the office.
Even when we were making love a while ago, you were thinking of her, Holly goes, as she returns from the bathroom. Duane, this is so hurtful.
She takes the drink I give her. Holly, I go.
No, it's true, Duane.
She walks up and down the room in her underpants and bra with the drink in her hand.
You've gone outside the marriage. It's our trust you've broken. Maybe that sounds old-fashioned to you. I don't care. Now I just feel like, I don't know what, like dirt. That's what I feel like. I'm confused. I don't have a purpose anymore. You were my purpose.
This time she lets me take her hand. I get down on my knees on the carpet and put her fingers against my temples.
I love her. Christ, yes, I love her. But at that very minute, too, I'm thinking of Juanita. Her fingers rubbing my neck that time. This is awful. I don't know what's going to happen. I go, Holly, honey, I love you. But I don't know what else to say or what else I can offer under the circumstances. She runs her fingers back and forth across my forehead as if she is a blind person being asked to describe my face. In the lot, someone leans on a horn, stops, starts again. Holly takes her hand away, wipes her eyes. She goes, fix me a drink. This one's too weak. Let them blow their horns. I don't care. I think I'll move to Nevada. Don't talk crazy, I go. I'm not talking crazy, she goes. I just said I think I'll move to Nevada. Nothing's crazy about that. Maybe I can find someone there who'll love me. You can stay here with your Mexican maid. I think I'll move to Nevada. Either that or I'm going to kill myself. Holly. Holly nothing, she goes. She sits on the sofa and draws her knees up under her chin. It's getting dark outside and inside. I pull the curtain and switch on the table lamp. I said fix me another drink, son of a bitch. She goes, fuck those hornblowers. Let them go down the street to the Travel Lodge. Is that where your Mexican girlfriend works now? The Travel Lodge? I'll bet she helps that sleepy bear get into his pajamas every night. Well, fix me another drink and put some scotch in it this time. She sets her lips and gives me a fierce look. Drinking's funny. When I look back on it, all of our important decisions have been taken when we were drinking. Even when we talked about having to cut back on our drinking, we'd be sitting at the kitchen table or out at a picnic table in the park with a six-pack or a bottle of whiskey in front of us. When we decided to move down here and take this motel job, leave our town, friends and relations, everything, we sat up all night drinking and talking, weighing the pros and cons, getting drunk over it. But we used to be able to handle it. And this morning, when Holly suggests we need a serious talk about our lives, the first thing I do before we lock the office and go upstairs for our talk is run to the liquor store for the teachers. I pour the last of it into our glasses and add another ice cube and a little water. Holly gets off the sofa and stretches out across the bed. She goes, did you make love to her in this bed too? I did not. Well, it doesn't matter, she goes. Not much matters anymore anyway. I've got to recover myself, though, that much is for sure. I don't answer. I feel wiped out. I give her the glass and sit down in the big chair. I sip my drink and think, what now? Dwayne, she goes. Holly? My fingers curl around the glass. My heart has slowed. I wait. Holly was my true love. The thing with Juanita had gone on 5 days a week between the hours of 10 and 11 for 6 weeks. At first, we contrived to meet in one unit or another as she was making her rounds. I'd just walk in where she was working and shut the door behind me. But after a time, that seemed risky, and she adjusted her routine so that we began meeting in 22, a unit at the end of the motel that faced east toward the mountains, whose front door couldn't be seen from the office window. We were sweet with each other, but swift. We were swift and sweet at the same time, but it was fine. It was entirely new and unexpected, that much more pleasure. Then one fine morning, Bobby, the other maid, she walks in on us. These women worked together, but they were not friends. Like that, she went to the office and told Holly. Why she'd do such a thing, I couldn't understand then and still can't. Juanita was scared and ashamed. She dressed and drove home. I saw Bobby outside a while later and sent her home, too. I wound up putting the units in order myself that day. Holly kept to the office, drinking, I suspect. I stayed clear. But when I came into the apartment before I went to work, she was in the bedroom with the door closed. I listened. I heard her asking the employment service for another maid. I heard her hang up the telephone. Then she began that hum. I was undone. I went on to work, but I knew there'd be a reckoning. I think Holly and I could maybe have weathered that. Even though she was wild drunk when I got in from work that night and threw a glass at me and said awful things we could never either of us forget. I slapped her for the first time ever that night, and then begged her forgiveness for slapping her and for getting involved with someone.
I begged her to forgive me. There was a lot of crying and soul-searching and more drinking. We were up most of the night. Then we went to bed exhausted and made love. It simply was not mentioned again, the business with Juanita. There'd been the outburst, and then we proceeded to act as if the other hadn't happened. So maybe she was willing to forgive me, if not to forget it, and life could go on. What we hadn't counted on was that I would find myself missing Juanita and sometimes unable to sleep nights for thinking about her. I'd lie in bed after Holly was asleep and think about Juanita's white teeth, and then I'd think about her breasts. The nipples were dark and warm to the touch, and there were little hairs growing just below the nipples. She had hair under her arms as well. I must have been crazy. After a couple of weeks of this, I realized I had to see her again, God help me. I called one evening from work and we arranged that I would stop by. I went to her house that night after work. She was separated from her husband and lived in a little house with two children. I got there just after midnight. I was uncomfortable, but Juanita knew it and put me at ease right away. We drank a beer at the kitchen table. She got up and stood behind my chair and rubbed my neck and told me to relax. Relax and let go. In her robe, she sat down at my feet and took my hand and began to clean under my fingernails with a little file. Then I kissed her and lifted her up, and we walked into the bedroom. In an hour or so, I dressed, kissed her goodbye, and went home to the motel. Holly knew. Two people who have been so close, you can't keep that kind of thing secret for long. Nor would you want to. You know something like that can't go on and on. Something has to give. Worse, you know you're in a constant state of deception. It's no kind of life. I held on to the night job. A monkey could do that work. But things were going downhill fast at the motel. We just didn't have the heart for it any longer. I stopped cleaning the swimming pool, and it began to fill with algae so that guests wouldn't use it. I didn't repair any more faucets or lay any more tile or do any touch-up painting. Even if we'd had the heart for it, there was just never enough time with one thing and the other, the drinking especially. That consumes a great deal of time and effort if you devote yourself to it fully. Holly began some very serious drinking of her own during this time. When I came in from work, whether I'd been by Juanita's or not, Holly would either be asleep and snoring, the bedroom smelling of whiskey, or else she'd be up at the kitchen table smoking her filter tip, a glass of something in front of her, eyes red and staring as I came in the door. She was not registering guests right either, charging too much or else, most often, not collecting enough. Sometimes she'd assign three people to a room with only one double bed, or else she'd put a single party in one of the suites that had a king-size bed and a sofa and charge the party for a single room only, that sort of thing. Guests complained, and sometimes there were words. People would load up and go somewhere else after demanding their money back. There was a threatening letter from the motel management people. Then another letter, certified. Telephone calls. Someone was coming down from the city to look into matters. But we had stopped caring, and that's a fact. We knew things had to change. Our days at the motel were numbered. A new wind was blowing. Our lives fouled and ready for a shake-up. Holly's a smart woman, and I think she knew all this before I did. That the bottom had fallen out. Then, that Saturday morning, we woke up with hangovers after an all-night rehashing of the situation that hadn't gotten us anywhere. We opened our eyes and turned in bed to look at each other. We both knew it at the same time, that we'd reached the end of something. We got up and dressed, had coffee as usual, and that's when she said we had to talk now without interruption, no phone calls, no guests. That's when I drove to the liquor store. When I came back, we locked it up and went upstairs with ice, glasses, and the teachers. We propped up pillows and lay in bed and drank and didn't discuss anything at all. We watched color TV and frolicked and let the phone ring away downstairs. We drank scotch and ate cheese crisps from the machine down the hall. There was a funny sense of anything could happen now that we realized everything was lost. We knew without having to say it that something had ended. But what was about to begin and take its place? Neither of us could think on yet. We dozed, and sometime later in the day, Holly raised herself off my arm. I opened my eyes at the movement. She sat up in bed. Then she screamed and rushed away from me toward the window.
When we were just kids before we were married?
Holly goes.
When we drove around every night and spent every possible minute together and talked and had big plans and hopes? Do you remember?
She was sitting in the center of the bed, holding her knees and her drink. I remember, Holly.
You weren't my first boyfriend. My first boyfriend was named Wyatt, and my folks didn't think much of him, but you were my first lover. You were my first lover then, and you've been my only lover since. Imagine. I didn't think I was missing that much. Now who knows what I was missing all those years. But I was happy. Yes, I was. You were my everything, just like the song. But I don't know now what was wrong with me all those years loving just you and only you. My God, I've had the opportunities.
I know you have, I go. You're an attractive woman. I know you've had the opportunities.
But I didn't take them up on it, that's the point,
she goes.
I didn't. I couldn't go outside the marriage. It was beyond comprehension.
Ollie, please, I go. No more now, honey. Let's not torture ourselves. What is it that we should do now?
Listen,
she goes.
Do you remember that time we drove out to that old farm place outside of Yakima, out past Terrace Heights? We were just driving around. It was a Saturday like today. We came to those orchards, and then we were on a little dirt road, and it was so hot and dusty. We kept going and came to that old farmhouse. We stopped and went up to the door and knocked and asked if we could have a drink of cool water. Can you imagine us doing something like that now? Going up to a strange house and asking for a drink of water?
We'd be shot.
Those old people must be dead now,
she goes.
Side by side out there in Terrace Heights Cemetery. But that day the old farmer and his wife, they not only gave us a glass of water, they invited us in for cake. We talked and ate cake in the kitchen, and later they asked if they could show us around. They were so kind to us. I haven't forgotten. I appreciate kindness like that. They showed us through the house. They were so nice with each other. I still remember the inside of that house. I've dreamed about it from time to time, the inside of that house, those rooms. But I never told you those dreams. A person has to have some secrets, right? But they showed us around on the inside, those nice big rooms and their furnishings. Then they took us out back. We walked around and they pointed out that little, what did they call it? Gazebo. I'd never seen one before. It was in a field under some trees. It had a little peaked roof. But the paint was gone and weeds were growing up over the steps. The woman said that years before we were born even, musicians had come out there to play on Sundays. She and her husband and their friends and neighbors would sit around in their Sunday clothes and listen to music and drink lemonade. I had a flash then. I don't know what else to call it. But I looked at that woman and her husband and I thought, someday we'll be old like that. Old but dignified, you know, like they were. Still loving each other more and more, taking care of one another, grandchildren coming to visit, all those things. I remember you were wearing cutoffs that day, and I remember standing there looking at the gazebo and thinking about those musicians when I happened to glance down at your bare legs. I thought to myself, I'll love those legs even when they're old and thin and the hair on them has turned white. I'll love them even then, I thought, they'll still be my legs. You know what I'm saying, Duane? Then they walked with us to the car and shook hands with us. They said we were nice young people. They invited us to come back, but of course we never did. They're dead now. They'd have to be dead. But here we are. I know something now I didn't know then. Don't I know it? It's such a good thing, isn't it? A person can't look into the future. But now here we are in this awful town, a couple of people who drink too much, running a motel with a dirty old swimming pool in front of it. And you in love with someone else. Duane, I've been closer to you than to anyone on earth. I feel crucified.
I can't say anything for a minute. Then I go, Holly, these things, we'll look back on them someday when we're old and we will be old together. You'll see, and we'll go, remember that motel with the cruddy swimming pool? And then we'll laugh at the things we did crazy. You'll see. It'll be all right. Holly? But Holly sits there on the bed with her empty glass and just looks at me. Then she shakes her head. She knows. I move over to the window and look from behind the curtain. Someone says something below and rattles the door to the office. I wait. I tighten my fingers on the glass. I pray for a sign from Holly. I pray without closing my eyes. I hear a car start, then another. The cars turn on their lights against the building and one after the other, pull away and out into the traffic. Dwayne, Holly goes. In this, as in most matters, she was right.
Want to see something? I was in bed when I heard the gate unlatch. I listened carefully. I didn't hear anything else, but I had heard that. I tried to wake Cliff, but he was passed out. So I got up and went to the window. A big moon hung over the mountains that surrounded the city. It was a white moon and covered with scars. Easy enough to imagine a face there. Eye sockets, nose, even the lips. There was enough light that I could see everything in the backyard. Lawn chairs, the willow tree, clotheslines strung between the poles, my petunias, and the fence enclosing the yard, the gate standing open. But nobody was moving around outside. There were no dark shadows. Everything lay in bright moonlight, and the smallest things came to my attention. The clothespins standing in orderly rows on the line, for instance, and the two empty lawn chairs. I put my hands on the cool glass, hiding the moon, and looked some more. I listened. Then I went back to bed. But I couldn't sleep. I kept turning over. I thought about the gate standing open like an invitation. Cliff's breathing was ragged. His mouth gaped and his arms hugged his pale, bare chest. He was taking up his side of the bed and most of mine. I pushed and pushed on him, but he just groaned. I stayed in bed a while longer until finally I decided it was no use. I got up and found my slippers. I went to the kitchen where I made a cup of tea and sat with it at the kitchen table. I smoked one of Cliff's unfiltereds. It was late. I didn't want to look at the time. I had to get up for work in a few hours. Cliff had to get up too, but he'd gone to bed hours ago and would be okay when the alarm went off. Maybe he'd have a headache. But he'd put away lots of coffee and take his time in the bathroom. Pour aspirin and he'd be all right. I drank the tea and smoked another cigarette. After a while, I decided to go out and fasten the gate. So I found my robe. Then I went to the back door. I looked and could see stars, but it was the moon that drew my attention and lighted everything. House and trees, utility poles and power lines, the entire neighborhood. I peered around the backyard before I stepped off the porch. A little breeze came along that made me close the robe. I started toward the open gate. There was a noise at the fence that separated our house from Sam Lawton's. I looked quickly. Sam was leaning with his arms on the fence, gazing at me. He raised a fist to his mouth and gave a dry cough.
"Evening, Nancy," he said.
I said, "Sam, you scared me. What are you doing up, Sam? Did you hear something? I heard my gate unlatch."
"I've been out here a while, but I haven't heard anything," he said. "Haven't seen anything either. It might have been the wind. That's it. Still, if it was latched, it shouldn't have come open."
He was chewing something. He looked at the open gate and then he looked at me again and shrugged. His hair was silvery in the moonlight and stood up on his head. It was so light out I could see his long nose, even the deep lines in his face. I said, "What are you doing up, Sam?" and moved closer to the fence.
"Hunting," he said. "I'm hunting. You want to see something? Come over here, Nancy, and I'll show you something."
"I'll come around," I said, and started along the side of our house to the front gate. I let myself out and went down the sidewalk. I felt strange, walking around outside in my nightgown and robe. I thought to myself that I must remember this, walking around outside in my nightgown. I could see Sam standing near the side of his house in his robe, his pajamas stopping just at the tops of his white and tan Oxfords. He was holding a big flashlight in one hand and a can of something in the other. He motioned me with his light. I opened the gate. Sam and Cliff used to be friends.
Then one night they were drinking. They had an argument. The next thing, Sam had built a fence between the houses. Then Cliff decided to build his own fence. That was not long after Sam had lost Millie, remarried, and become a father again. All in the space of little more than a year. Millie, Sam's first wife, was a good friend of mine up until she died. She was only 45 when she had heart failure. Apparently, it hit her just as she turned their car into the driveway. She slumped over the wheel, the car kept going, and knocked through the back of the carport. When Sam ran out of the house, he found her dead. Sometimes at night, we'd hear a howling sound from over there that he must have been making. We'd look at each other when we heard that and not be able to say anything. I'd shiver. Cliff would fix himself another drink. Sam and Millie had a daughter who'd left home at 16 and gone to San Francisco to become a flower child. From time to time over the years, she'd sent cards, but she never came back home. Sam tried, but he couldn't locate her when Millie died. He wept and said he lost his daughter first and then the mother. Millie was buried, Sam howled, and then after a little while, he started going out with Lori something or other, a younger woman, a school teacher who did some income tax preparations on the side. It was a brief courtship. They were both lonely and in need. So they married, and then they had a baby. But here's the sad thing. The baby was albino. I saw it a few days after they brought it home from the hospital. It was an albino, no question of that, right down to its poor little fingertips. Its eyes were tinged with pink around the iris instead of being white, and the hair on its head was as white as an old person's. Its head seemed overlarge, too. But I haven't been around that many babies, so that could have been imagination on my part. The first time I saw it, Lori was standing on the other side of its crib, arms crossed, the skin on the backs of her hands broken out, anxiety making her lips twitch. I know she was afraid I'd peep into the crib and gasp or something, but I was prepared. Cliff had already filled me in. In any case, I'm usually good at covering up my real feelings.